Next Talks connects professionals in the life science, medical device, and food industries with useful content like webinars, job openings, articles, and virtual meetings to help you succeed in your career. This Life Science Focus podcast brings together some of our editorial staff to share insights into the latest B2B industry news to keep you up to date. This week on the show, we are discussing the UK backing the world's costliest drug, Lymildi, for the treatment of MLD. And a new report finds a huge increase in pharma cybersecurity threats. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the X-Talks Life Science Podcast. I'm Aisha Rashid, Senior Life Science Journalist at xtalks.com, and this week I'm joined by Sydney Perlmutter and Vera Kovacevich. Thanks for coming today. So I'm going to start us off with a story about the world's most expensive drug being recommended by the UK's NHS. So the National Health Service, or the NHS in the UK, has backed the use of Lymildi for the treatment of a rare genetic disease called metachromatic leukodystrophy, or MLD. MLD is a lipid storage disease that's caused by defects in the production of the fatty myelin coating on nerve fibers in the central and peripheral nervous systems, or otherwise known as the white matter of these systems. And so defects in the production of the myelin leads to severe neurological and organ damage, which can prove to be fatal. Lymildi is a one-time treatment, and it's a gene therapy with a list price of £2.8 million, which is approximately $3.8 million. Lymildi is developed by a company called Orchard Therapeutics, and it first received approval from the European Commission in December of 2020. And about a month or so later, it received a regenerative medicine advanced therapy designation from the FDA to expedite its path to approval in the US. So interestingly, this orphan drug was first rejected by the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, or NICE, in the UK, which is the drug price watchdog in England. And of course, taking a look at its list price, the agency said that it was way too expensive and had yet to prove long-term effectiveness. However, upon further discussions with Orchard Therapeutics, the NHS was able to negotiate an additional discount, which remains undisclosed, on the drug. And so this allows the NHS to now offer it to patients. So Lymildi is officially recommended by the NHS for children with MLD who don't have symptoms or who can still walk without assistance. And so MLD, the incidence of MLD is about 1 in 100,000 worldwide. And in the UK, about 4 or 5 children are diagnosed with it every year. It's an autosomal recessive disorder, which means that if both parents are carriers of the gene that causes the disease, there's a 1 in 4 chance that their child will develop it. And there are 3 main forms of it, which include late infantile, which can develop between 12 and 20 months after birth, juvenile onset, which begins between ages 4 to 14, and then an adult onset form, where symptoms present from anywhere in the 20s to the 40s. And the life expectancy for the late infantile form is between 5 and 8 years old. And symptoms of late infantile MLD include difficulty walking, talking, mental deficits, including concentration issues, developmental delays, muscle wasting and weakness, and progressive loss of vision that can lead to blindness, as well as things like convulsions, seizures, and paralysis. And the symptoms get progressively worse over time, and patients can become comatose. And again, I think the mortality rate is like 50%. So it's a very devastating disease. There is no cure for it, and current treatments before LIVMELDY were focused on alleviating symptoms and supportive care. Bone marrow transplantation is also used in some infantile onset cases just to help delay disease progression. So again, this is a pretty significant breakthrough with this orphan drug for the treatment of this, again, very disease, which can be very severe and fatal. So the drug's approval in the EU was based on analysis of clinical trial data, which included both pre- and early symptomatic, as well as early onset MLD patients. And data from that trial showed that a single dose treatment was effective in modulating disease progression in most early onset MLD patients. LIVMELDY is a lentiviral vector-based gene therapy, and it delivers working copies of the ARSA or ARSA gene, which is mutated in MLD. And this gene is encodes for an enzyme called ARSA as well, which is involved in breaking down excess, basically a type of fat called sulfatide, and this is a key component of myelin. So, of course, impairments of this enzyme lead to the toxic buildup of this type of fat in the nervous system as well as organs, and which can prove to be fatal and cause the symptoms that it does. So the NHS's chief executive, Amanda Pritchard, said that this revolutionary drug is a lifesaver for the babies and young children who suffer from this devastating hereditary disorder. And also in the BBC, actually, there was a really nice article which talked about a family who has a child with MLD and how the child received this gene therapy, received LIVMELDY, I think it was about 7 years ago, and how the child is, you know, you can't even tell that she has the disease because she's, I don't know if cure is the word because, again, still need to evaluate the long-term effectiveness, but it's been life-changing for the child and their families. So it was really great to read about that. So the drug is only recommended in England right now. Patients in places like Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland will have to travel over to Manchester where they have the center that is making this drug available, and they will have to obtain funding from their national health systems. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. I know we talked about, I forget what it was, but I think a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, we did talk about rare diseases and orphan drugs and just the costs that are associated with the development and, you know, the availability and administering these orphan treatments, and how it's really important that you do have government health systems working in conjunction with companies developing these treatments to really make them accessible to patients. And I think this just like goes along with that theme. It's going to be interesting to see how things pan out in the US with this drug because they are expecting it to get approval. So what do you think about this $3.8 million drug?
I think maybe you should have put your pinky to your mouth when you said that, because that was so shocking. Like, yeah. I mean, I also had a question regarding the disease. What are the methods of testing? How would one find out that they had this disease?
A genetic testing, right? Because it's a genetic disease, so. If you have a known family history, I guess, then parents would have to, it would be a good idea for them to get genetic counseling, genetic testing, and then counseling, and just following any kind of genetic condition that could be passed down to their kids. So, yeah, that's how it's diagnosed. And of course, if a child is born and it wasn't known that the parents might have been carriers of the mutation. I think I was just
looking over, but some of the initial symptoms are difficulty concentrating, difficulty walking. And I think that article in the BBC, I think those were some of the first symptoms that the child had in that story. So yeah, like there are kind of very, which could be vague symptoms as well, but again, because they get progressively worse, that would merit a visit to the doctor and genetic testing to see whether this could be MLD.
I also wonder whether the price is so high, not only because it's a rare disease, but it's one that mainly, you know, affects children. I don't know if there's any correlation between that and the price, but I just thought maybe there's something there.
I mean, maybe pediatric clinical trials are harder to run.
That's a good point, yeah.
But yeah, we did talk about how for rare diseases, because the smaller the market is, the more costly the treatment will be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I never like to talk about the costs of drugs because, like, ultimately it's like, well, how much is a life worth? And I think it's worth as much as it needs to be. Like, you know, I understand these costs are enormous, but I think they're worth it at the end because this is a very promising treatment. But yeah, maybe we can talk more about, like, how did they get that number of several million? Like, is it just because the gene therapies are really hard to develop and, like, the pharma companies invest a lot in gene therapy research? This is, to me at least, this is a relatively newer kind of treatment. I mean, they really have to reevaluate because it's not like, okay, a cost per pill, right? Mm-hmm. This potentially is only a one-time treatment, perhaps, and it could extremely help the patient. So.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with just the development of it. So gene therapies are not cheap. And also they are, you know, they're still sort of developmental. I mean, they're not so widespread, right? You have only for a handful of diseases, really, where gene therapies have made it to late stage clinical trials and have gotten approvals. So I think because the field is still so new, their development, their manufacturing, their commercialization, all of that, I think that's why it's still so expensive to conduct and the trials as well, because, you know, you're talking about, if you're talking especially about rare diseases, it's a lot more expensive and difficult to conduct trials where it's hard to recruit, you know, find the patient populations for those trials. And so, yeah, the way this gene therapy works is that cells from hematopoietic stem cells from the patient are taken, and then the therapy is then inserted into the cells, and then those cells, or the gene, the working copy of the gene is inserted to the cells via the lentiviral vector, and then those cells are reinjected back into the patient. So I think all of that, you know, it's still, like I said, it's still sort of in, it's not like mass production of like a pill or some kind of a, you know, antibiotic. It's not there yet at all. So it's still very costly. But it is interesting because we don't really have, there's not really a lot of information about, like, yeah, why is it $2 million or why is something, you know, there's not much information out there at all. And it's just like, oh, well, this is just how much it costs, and work with the governments and work with the companies and try to figure out how to make this more accessible. So yeah, it'd be interesting to sort of get more details on how that pricing is determined. All right, so let's move on to another story. And this has to do with pharma cybersecurity threats. So a new report has found that there has been a significant increase in cybersecurity threats in the pharma sphere. So a report, findings from an analysis conducted by Constella Intelligence, which is a digital risk protection company, show that widespread cybersecurity vulnerabilities are costing pharma companies significant amounts of money. Now, the agency released their report, which focused on the analysis of digital risks to the top 20 pharma companies on the Fortune Global 500 list. And the report includes information on things like breaches, exposures, and leaks among the top 20 pharma companies that they took a look at. And it includes data from January 2018 to September 2021. And it was obtained through analysis of identity records from data breaches and leaks that were spotted in open sources as well as on the surface, deep, and dark web. So according to Constella, they identified over 9,000 breaches or leakages and more than 4.5 million exposed records. And almost two-thirds of the pharma cybersecurity breaches included personally identifiable information items like email addresses, phone numbers, passwords, and even credit and banking information. And the sensitive information exposures were mostly related to employee corporate credentials and also relatives, information of relatives as well that were inputted into these databases. If these pharma cybersecurity breaches expand and become, you know, widely circulating, this could open up the potential to cyber attacks such as phishing, impersonation, as well as account takeover. And then these could lead to even more coordinated higher level attacks such as ransomware or coordinated disinformation campaigns. And Constella said that in the worst case scenarios, they can impact supply chains, leading to theft of trade secrets and also cause reputational damage to companies. So according to the report, approximately 59% of the total pharma cybersecurity breaches and 76% of total exposed records that were identified in Constella's report occurred after 2020. So this indicates that both are escalating in the pharma sector at an alarming rate, according to Constella. And things got worse in 2021, which is, of course, concerning because this was during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic efforts, including vaccine distribution, as well as distribution of treatments for COVID-19 as well. And among a pool of 78 top pharma company executives, 58% were found to have had their corporate credentials exposed in a third-party breach or leakage since 2018. So that is pretty significant there. Now, if we talk about cybersecurity and cyber attacks in pharma, so one of the most notable cyber attacks that occurred recently in pharma occurred in 2017, and this was Merck's NotPetya incident, and it was linked to the Russian military. So this attack cost Merck almost $1 billion, and it targeted its in-house API production, and it specifically impacted formulation and packaging systems along with R&D and other segments as well. Now, Merck is going to be able to recover these losses through a payout that it recently received for $1.4 billion from its insurers. But this payout only came after a fierce legal battle between the two. So Merck's insurers had denied coverage for the attack, saying that the policy excluded acts of war. However, a New Jersey court ruled just a few weeks ago, back in January of this year, that the insurer could not claim this act of war exclusion because it only applies to military conflict. So they couldn't get out of that one. So Merck is now set to receive the $1.4 billion payout to cover its losses. Also, interestingly, the New York Times reported that a PR firm had attempted to recruit social media influencers in France and Germany to make misleading claims about Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine. And according to the New York Times, the trail was found to lead to Russia after some other influencers began to look into this issue. So how do companies protect themselves from these kinds of cyber attacks? Well, a digital intelligence specialist at Constella, Jonathan Nelson, actually says that, you know, one of the main things that companies can do is to just continuously be monitoring their operations and also have company-wide password protocols, use secure VPNs, and also invest in cybersecurity infrastructure for things like remote work, which can add layers of protection. So we have talked about cybersecurity attacks in the food realm, in the food industry, which that you know, we heard a lot about that from Sydney on the food podcast. So this was very interesting to see. You know, we don't really hear a lot about cyber attacks and things like this in pharma, but I mean, I'm sure there are groups out there because pharma is obviously huge. And so just wanted to get your thoughts about this. Was this just inevitable, or are you surprised or not surprised?
Yeah, I mean, I gotta say, I'm not too surprised because there's a lot of, you know, money in the, you know, pharmaceutical industry. But then again, it's also one of those vulnerable industries as well, because people rely on the pharmaceutical industry, you know, some people on a daily basis. And it totally makes sense that it would be the target of cyber attacks. And much like food, you know, there's only so many things that companies can do to protect themselves. And I feel like it's becoming a more and more common occurrence just in many different industries. So I think we're going to be seeing more companies investing in, like you said, investing in software and like other measures to be able to protect themselves, because even if you're doing, you know, if you think you're doing all you can, you may not be safe. So, yeah. Not surprised, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually was surprised because I was thinking, like, well, why would cyber criminals want to target pharma companies? And I was thinking, are they trying to, like, find out some of, like, the secrets of the pharma company?
Trade
trying
secrets.
To, yeah, trade secrets. Are they trying to see, like, what's the newest discovery they made? But then I realized it's probably just to steal, you know, health and patient data, ultimately. Maybe that's what most of the attacks are trying to do. I mean, I could be wrong, but, like, you know, I don't really know why pharma is targeted so much besides the fact that they have a lot of data from people. And I also think, like, the switch to a lot of maybe employees working from home and remotely could make it an easier target. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe that's why there's an increase since 2020.
Yeah, definitely. I think that is a contributing factor. The fact that, you know, working from remote work, you know, not everyone is on secure VPNs and things like that. So it just makes it more vulnerable to attack and breaches. Also, you know, I think in Sydney, you had a story about a ransomware attack, I think, affecting the meat industry. So mm-hmm. the same with pharma. It can come down just to money, right? Where they're just holding these companies to ransom. And so it's big, and their pharma is huge. And again, like, you know, how we've said, huge, huge, you know, stakes here. And what was really concerning is when, you know, they were really talking about how it increased over the pandemic and how it could affect things like supply chains. So imagine, you know, like things like the COVID-19 vaccines, which already, you know, there were a lot of distribution issues in the beginning in some places. So if there was, you know, a concerted attack that really impacted, you know, supply chains, that would have, you know, delayed things so much. And so it really, you know, hits home when you think about it. And who knows what else, right? I mean, so many medications and like we rely on the daily, some people. So it's just very concerning. Yeah, eye-opening, I think. Okay, so that's the end of this episode of the X Talks Life Science podcast. If you liked today's show, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Thanks, everyone, and see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the X Talks Life Science podcast. If you enjoyed our discussions today, please share the episode with your friends and colleagues, and be sure to subscribe in order to be notified when a new episode is released. To join in on the discussion, you can find X-Talks on social media, email podcast@xtalks.com, or comment on the articles directly. Links are in the show description. Take a moment to join our community at xtalks.com to get access to everything we have to offer, including webinars, job listings, virtual meetings, articles, and more. The views and opinions expressed in the podcast are those of the speakers sharing them. They should not be taken as professional advice and do not necessarily reflect the policy or position Honeycomb Worldwide. For further information, email us at podcast@xtalks.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.